Welcome, everyone, especially to some old friends from afar. So some of you might have been here last week. Gene gave the talk, and one thing that he brought up was developing a kind of regularity in Zazen practice. Making a regular practice, finding the same time each day, and if we have a busy life, even just to sit 10 or 15 minutes is good. But make it a regular practice. Sometimes we don't talk about things so specifically like that, so I thought that was nice, and it got me thinking about developing a path of practice. Like, I've brought up some of these kinds of things in the past, but it's been a while. I feel like I'm often exploring the view or the understanding of how things are, and so I thought here we could just talk about the kind of practical development of a lifetime of Zen practice. Dogen Zenji, our ancient Zen founder, has an essay called Continuous Practice. And in that he says, on the great way of the Buddhas and ancestors, there is always unsurpassable practice, continuous and sustained. It forms the circle of the way and is never cut off. Between aspiration, practice, realization, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. So that's an expression of, it might look like there's stages of practice, like the first aspiration or inspiration to practice, and then practice and realization, awakening, nirvana. But Dogen says there's no gap between these, actually. We could even say they're all happening now. They must be happening now because there is no other time than now. So with this spirit of gaplessness and always eternally now, and also the spirit of that we are complete from the start, there's nothing lacking, then we can talk about kind of stages of practice. We could say if we're complete from the start, then what's the practice doing? And we could say it's developing, it's a gradual developing of trust in the truth that we're complete as we are. We are complete as we are, the Buddhas say, but means like we lack nothing, and it's really basically fundamentally all okay. We hear this kind of thing, and sometimes we trust it, but we don't always trust it. So we could say practice, the gradual development of practice, is like deepening the trust in our true nature, which is complete and lacking nothing. And then based on that trust, opening up our heart of compassion and kindness that I think really truly springs forth from this trust in the completeness of ourselves and everyone. So Dogen goes on in Continuous Practice to say, your practice affects the entire earth and the entire sky in the 10 directions. Although not noticed by others or by yourself, it is so. Your practice affects the whole world affects everything. And it's, you can't see this and others can't see this for the most part. But it is so, and this is also the Buddha's law of cause and effect, that everything we do, every little activity, from raising an eyebrow to building a skyscraper, has an effect. So of course our practice has an effect. Dogen says, continuous practice is not necessarily something that people in the world are fond of, but it is the place of refuge for everyone. I think he's always weaving back and forth between practice as just opening to our true nature here and now, and what we might call formal practice, the practice that's actually manifest in the forms of the Zen tradition, particularly what we call Zazen, seated meditation. So in both cases, formal and inconceivable practice, it's not necessarily something that everyone in the world is fond of or even has heard of, but it is the place of refuge for everyone. And Dogen says, the effect of such sustained practice is sometimes not hidden. Therefore, you aspire to practice. The effect is sometimes not revealed or not evident. Therefore, you may not see, hear, or know it. Understand that although the effect of practice is not necessarily apparent, it is not really hidden. I think it's interesting that he says, sometimes the effect of practice is not hidden, and therefore you aspire to practice. And I would venture to say that, to some extent anyway, that that is probably the case for all of us in this room. Because that's why we come back, because the effect of practice is sometimes not hidden. If it were always hidden, if it was like, there's no effect of this practice, it doesn't do anything, it doesn't do any good at all, we probably wouldn't come more than once. And thus we were either really crazy or really enlightened. But sometimes the effect is not hidden. You could say the basic effects are like, there's more peacefulness in our life. There's more openness. There's more presence. So that's a little bit about practice in general from Dogen. Continuous practice that can't be divided into divisions and periods and stages, and yet can be spoken of as manifesting in all these various forms. So then we have this practice, this Zen practice, but then in this particular temple we're emphasizing lay practice, right? Like it's not a monastery. I think practice, Zen practice started in monasteries in China and Korea and Japan. So this is kind of a new thing that we're trying out in America in the last 50 years. Wholehearted, like full-on Zen practice outside the monastery for everyone. And there's places where Dogen in the 13th century is already kind of talking about this and encouraging this. So this is in the Endeavor of the Way, the Bendowa, a series of questions and answers. Someone asked Dogen, Monks are free from various obligations, and so they don't have hindrances to practicing zazen in the endeavor of the way. How can lay people with many duties and obligations practice single-mindedly and accord with Buddha Dharma? So, 800 years ago, they were already asking this kind of question in Japan. And I think one way we talk about lay practice is you're bringing the spirit of mindfulness and presence and vow and and kindness and compassion into one's whole complicated life. And of course that is a central part of practice. But here, the person's asking particularly about practicing zazen, like sitting meditation, which, you know, seems to sort of take some time in one's busy day. It's something in addition to just presence and compassion. So Dogen answers this question. Buddhas and ancestors in their kindness have opened the wide gate of compassion in order to let all living beings enter realization. Who cannot enter? And he says, he quotes many examples of ancient people in China who, lay people who realized the way. And then Dogen says, it just depends on whether you have the willingness or not. That's all it depends on. Just depends on whether you have the willingness or not. It doesn't matter whether you're a lay person or a monk or living in a monastery or a complicated household. Those who can discern what is valuable and excellent invariably take up practice. That's where the willingness comes from. Again, sometimes the effects are not hidden, Dogen says. And therefore, some discern what is valuable and excellent. And then, this is classic line of Dogen here. Those who regard worldly obligations or secular affairs, worldly affairs, as a hindrance to Buddha Dharma only think that there is no Buddha Dharma in the secular world, and they don't understand that there's no secular world in Buddha Dharma. Uchiyama Roshi, when he's commenting on this line of Dogen, he says, one time a businessman, a very busy and stressed out businessman, came to learn zazen from me, and he was like almost in tears at the mess of his life and the complications of his life and business. And Uchiyama Roshi quoted this line of Dogen to him, and he didn't quite resonate with it at first, but he gradually took up the practice of zazen, and then he came back and said, that line is really, really helping me. And he started telling all of his friends this line of Dogen, that those who regard worldly obligations as a hindrance to Buddha Dharma only think that there's no Buddha Dharma in the secular world, and don't understand that there's no secular world in Buddha Dharma. Which I would understand to be, from the perspective of Dharma, any activity in the secular world can be pure practice. In other words, people don't understand that there is no secular world in Buddha Dharma. In other words, secular or mundane, everything is spiritual, you might say, in the realm of, from the perspective of Buddha Dharma. Therefore, anything can be practiced. Therefore, no activity in our life has to hinder our practice. So, in that spirit, I started thinking, actually so many years ago, I started thinking how about this particular practice place of Warm Jewel Temple, and how can we develop a really wholehearted path of lay practice. And I wrote up various things, and in at times of inspiration, and then I would look at it again and think, no, this is a crazy idea, I'll just forget about it. And I think I wrote this several years ago, but I came across it recently and thought, oh, you know, maybe this is not so crazy idea, maybe it's okay. And kind of, again, inspired by Jean bringing up this practical point about developing a regular zazen practice, I thought, we can go beyond that even. That's kind of the beginning. I thought, for those very new to practice, just coming to practice, I think that's, of course, we just check it out. People come to Intro to Zen, see if it resonates with them. It maybe does a little bit, so then they come sit some zazen, and then they feel like they want to, you know, I would say, you know, like, give it like a month or so of like making it somewhat regular. And I think that's especially where this kind of like 10 minutes a day or a few days a week for 10 minutes can start to check it out and see if the effects are sometimes not hidden and see if it's helpful to your life. And then from there, then this document that arose in my mind called the Zen Path of Practice and Realization takes off. At one point I showed this to the practice leaders, and I think they had some comments, but we never really talked about it. So this is could develop into something for as a Santa Cruz Zen Center official statement. But right now it's just my own inspiration. We haven't talked about it as a group. So this is not necessarily endorsed by all the practice leaders. So Dogen, another one of Dogen's trademark sayings is that practice and realization are not two. So it's not like practice is something that we do that eventually leads up to a realization. It's they're simultaneous. One moment of practice, true practice, which means like really dropping off body and mind, we might say, or just selfless activity, presence, and openness. And in many ways we can talk about practice, but a moment of such practice is a moment of confirming the realization of peace and openness and so on. So practice includes realization from the get-go all the way up to the end. So as you listen to this kind of sort of stages of Zen practice and the practices that go along with them, you can I see many people who have been practicing a long time here, some for a medium length of time, some maybe very new to practice. You can just see how you might fit into these different categories. And I would want to preface this by saying this is not like some required program or something, but it could be just inspiration. And I really thought about these different aspects over different, they're listed by numbers of years, actually. So this is when you really want to make Zen practice a long-term thing in your life, and how that kind of progresses and develops. And so it's just my own thoughts, based kind of like on my own practice path, which was mostly in monasteries, but I think everything here could be done here at this Zen Center or at home even. And with each of these kind of different developmental stages, I thought about the people in this Sangha, and I even wrote down like, you know, names of people at each stage, and it's kind of divided between these four different kind of stages, there's people on all of them here. So it's not like just a total dream. There's people actually doing all of it. And so here's how it goes. The first of these four paths, we could say, it's all one path, and the path is not going somewhere. It's just walking to walk kind of path. So the first one's called the foundational path. And each one has a purpose, a commitment, and a practice, and a study. So this first one is, the purpose is to establish a basis of ethical discipline, meditative concentration, and basic understanding of Buddha Dharma, the Buddha's basic teachings. This is kind of classic Buddhism, these three aspects of these, of practice called ethical discipline or the precepts, meditative concentration or just some form of meditation like Zazen, and wisdom, in this case, just the wisdom of actually hearing or reading the teachings and understanding the basis for practice. This such a rich tradition and understanding that's kind of the framework for both the ethical discipline and the meditation practice. So that's the purpose of this initial phase, which is, I put down as 1 to 3 years. So maybe after the initial checking out phase, this is when you're like, I actually want to kind of dig in here and take this up for 1 to 3 years, working on these three aspects of practice. And the commitment is to informally take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. We recite that every morning at service, and to explore what that means. That's kind of is what committing to practice has been since the time of Buddha. And therefore, we could attend the full moon precepts renewal ceremonies when we can, which is about this taking refuge and learning these precepts of conduct. And I also thought, in this foundational phase, it's nice to develop a really healthy sense of skepticism and actually test out the Dharma, especially at the beginning, because it might be like bogus path. So really, like, the Buddha encourages this, right? He says, don't take my word for it. It's good to learn some teachings and hear how the Buddha puts it, but don't just take his word for it. Check it out for yourself, right? They say, the Buddha taught, when we're checking out practice like this, we can be like a jeweler or a goldsmith that's testing gold, and you can like burn it or smelt it and cut it and, rub it to try to like check how many carats it is or check if it's real gold, right? You don't just look at it, it looks like gold, but it could be fool's gold. So there's a lot of practice paths that could be like fool's gold. So really check it out with a good sense of doubt and skepticism. I think it's a great way, especially starting practice. We often don't emphasize that. We say, just follow this way. No, you should doubt it. And like push the teachers on what they're saying and see if it really makes sense to you. And don't just let it go if it doesn't. And also during this initial phase, it might be a good thing to actually visit other Dharma centers and check out other traditions of Buddha Dharma. We usually don't say that either. We say like, if you're going to commit, like, this is the place. But in fact, I think especially at first, it's nice. And I myself felt this way. I first went to San Francisco Zen Center. I was living at Green Gulch in Tassajara. I think for maybe half a year or a year, somewhere in there. But I could see, like, I was doing some of this testing and checking and feeling like it's passing most of my tests. I feel like pretty good about this practice place and this practice path and tradition. I could feel myself almost like kind of going into the whirlpool, getting kind of pulled in. Like, I can see where this is going, that because as time goes on, I'm getting more and more into it, which probably means that I'm going to keep getting more and more into it. So before I get sucked down the whirlpool of Zen, let me like check out some other spiritual practice. So I went to India partly to go traveling, but partly to check out Tibetan Buddhism in India. And, you know, went to teachings over there, and I appreciated them, but it was interesting because I felt, after doing some checking out of this other tradition, they're like, I think it's too late. I think Zen is the thing. And I was already too far down the whirlpool or something. But I really appreciate, I think if I didn't do that, I would always be doubting it and thinking about, well, maybe there's another way. So that's part of my story. And then another part of my story is that much later, after I had been practicing Zen for some years and was ordained as a priest already, then I started getting really into checking out other traditions again. I think it was nice to have this, like, some years of, like, full-on, full-time, concentrated Zen practice to really understand that foundation and those teachings, and then to start exploring other ones. So I had this Theravada phase where I got really into especially the Thai forest tradition of Theravada Buddhism and also Tibetan Buddhism. And I think it's a beautiful thing in America, because we have all these traditions together, and they're, I think, very supportive and very mutually complement each other, but they have different angles that can also help us understand our own tradition. So I think my main Theravada teacher in those years was Ajahn Amaro, a really wonderful English monk at Abhayagiri monastery. And not only did I go up there and practice with him as a Zen priest various times, but when I would be exploring the Tibetan Dzogchen teachings, Ajahn Amaro would take all his Theravada monks up to receive teachings from Sokni Rinpoche, where I was also receiving teachings, Dzogchen Tibetan teachings. So I thought that was a beautiful example too, of these very senior practitioners attending teachings of other very senior practitioners and learning from different traditions together. A good friend of mine now who is currently Sokni Rinpoche's main translator and kind of attending and kind of helping run his vast international program, was almost became a monk with Ajahn Amaro. But on one of these visits, he got struck by Sokni Rinpoche and kind of switched over to the other side. So I think nice to check out other traditions, but especially in this initial phase, see what we really want to do. I mean, right down the street, there's the Insight Santa Cruz, who might really resonate with Vipassana practice more than Zen. And I think if people do, I would say, then please do that. I don't think we have a better way here. If we get into that, that's like sectarianism, and we don't want to get into that. I just love our way, and I want to make it open to everyone. So that might be part of these first 1 to 3 years. We're have a skepticism about our own tradition. We're checking out other practice traditions, and establishing a daily practice. And I would say, if we really want to step in, maybe after the initial phase, we make it like 30 minutes a day. I propose that everybody can find 30 minutes in their day, no matter how busy they are, because they're probably doing some things that they don't have to do. If If somebody has 23 hours and 30 minutes of total obligation, and not quite 30 minutes extra to spare, I'd say they're going to go insane. It's impossible. So it just might mean something that what it might mean in a busy, committed life with a lot of duties and obligations is it might mean giving up something that we like to do to relax. Which is kind of a nice test, because then it means zazen, this 30 minutes of zazen, would fit into the relaxation category. Instead of like another chore, I'm going to, like, if watching TV is relaxing, I'm going to like take 30 minutes of TV watching and put it into zazen. Which kind of like sort of tests our faith in that it really is enjoyable and relaxing. I think a lot of these practice things is, we do feel like they're helpful, but even myself would feel like this, but sometimes I get lazy about doing them. Even though when I'm doing it, I'm always like, of course, this is what I want to do. It's just that habitual mind that will be like, sometimes feel like there's something more interesting to do than just sitting doing nothing. Just being. There's something more interesting than just being. But actually, just being, it's the most nourishing thing ever when I'm actually doing it. So establishing this, daily, 5 days a week, and this is the kind of thing where if we miss a day or something, we don't get obsessed about it, but that's the art of commitment, right? It's like pretty much staying with it without getting really hard on ourselves if we don't. But if we get too, like, well, just try in that direction, then it usually doesn't happen. This is the art of, and the dance of making commitments. And in this model, I even have it set up as, over these different years, exploring different types of meditation, even though it's all Zen meditation. Even within Dogen's teaching, you see him writing different things about what Zazen is, actually. So, but this is not exactly Zen meditation, but classic, I think, really good way to start a meditation practice is mindfulness of breathing and mindfulness of body and feelings and mental states. It's related to classic Zen practice, and it's based on the early Theravada teachings, but it's, I think, the best foundation. In these first 3 years, doing a couple of one-day sittings, Zazen Kai or Sesshin retreats, like a few days a year. As I wrote, silent meditation retreats allow access to deeper dimensions of mind that daily Zazen usually does not reveal. I feel good about saying it like that. It's different. It's hard, and it's a bigger time commitment to do a one-day sitting or a sesshin, but it offers the non-hidden effects are different than the non-hidden effects of zazen, of just 30-minute day zazen. Also, in these initial years, establishing and maintaining a dokusan, or practice discussion relationship, with one or more practice leaders to explore zazen, practice in daily life, and dharma understanding. Part of classic, all these things are classic Zen, going back to before Dogen, right? Zazen, longer sesshins, and this one-on-one meeting, so helpful to clarify our practice and just to develop that kind of practice relationship. Here I wrote, in this initial phase, meeting like at least like once every 2 months. Sometimes people come like once every 2 years. And making a connection. And it doesn't mean like you have to have some big question to bring up. It's just exploring practice together. And then attending like Wednesday night talks. We have all these classes and talks and events and teachings and events here. Study groups and so on. And then I put a little reading list, things like what the Buddha taught, books like this, introductory. So that's 1 to 3 years. And then depending on what one wants to do, Because I think this is all, there's all different ways. But again, if one is like, yeah, I've been doing that and steadily, I love it, and I want to, what's the next step? Or could I add something in? Again, this is very, maybe most people would never be quite this structured in how the path naturally unfolds, but I think it's one way to look at it. So this next one section is called the Bodhisattva Path of Compassion. The first foundational teachings were just that. Now this is, the purpose is to develop bodhicitta, like the aspiration to realize awakening for the benefit of all beings, to realize complete selflessness so we can really benefit everyone selflessly. Develop openness to others and compassion. You know, we look at the bodhisattva precepts, the bodhisattva vows, the six perfections, and devotional practice and so on. So commitment is to informally take up these four bodhisattva vows, like really consider what they mean. And we have a lot of nice classes to explore that here regularly. Also, in this phase, this is after 1 to 3 years, sometime in this next phase, which is also 1 to 3 years, so it could be like 6 years after really deciding to take up the practice, request to formally receive the bodhisattva precepts from a practice leader. This is this Jukai ceremony that involves sewing a robe and receiving the precepts, like, formally. And I think it's nice to... There might be various reasons why people maybe don't want to do this or wait even longer, but I think sometime between the 3 and the 6 years is a kind of natural time. And if one doesn't want to do that, then that's interesting to explore, too, what's that about, because... Some people feel like, I can't keep all these precepts. My conduct is not that pure. And I think the secret that you might not have heard is everybody feels that way. The people who receive them, at least, I think so, is we can't keep these precepts. But they're like a direction that we want to go. They're a vow. They're a direction. And it seems to change people when they formally do this ceremony. And it's also just like, it's partly about the precepts and making a public statement that I want to live in this beneficial way to not harming others. And also it's connecting with this particular lineage. I think I really, in our Soto Zen ceremony, it has that quality too. And after those few years, then it's nice, I think, after exploring various traditions, it's nice to kind of like, even if one has multiple practice lineages, to kind of really commit to one, at least one, but like this is my central path. And so this has, that's commitment, so it might take a while to sew a rakusu and do this, but over these years, practice is continuing this daily practice. It could be learning mindfulness of the whole present, or zazen without a particular object, like the breath or the feelings or the body. We call that like calm abiding without a specific support. And adding in numbers of sesshin days. Committing to a practice period is a tradition we have at this temple for a long time now. It's a self-designed commitment to a practice period. This is the kind of thing that over time we naturally try these things out. Offering time and energy to the Sangha, like Sangha work days and cooking for the homeless shelters and cooking for sesshin, serving on the board, or other volunteer work outside of Zen Center also could fit into this Bodhisattva path of compassion. In other words, practice is not just about me at this point. We're expanding it. We're offering ourselves to the world more and more. Also, one could, thinking about this today, one, as far as commitment, one could also, especially if one doesn't, for various reasons, take up this Jukai ceremony of receiving the precepts, one could make personal vows, like personal specific commitments, like every time I pass a homeless person, I'm going to give them something. And nobody even needs to know about it, but it's just, this could be like a personal thing. Or one day every week, I'm not going to eat meat if I eat meat, or something that has a tangible benefit to sentient beings in this path of compassion. And then, you know, we can, even for like some length of time, and then we can expand it over time, or drop it. And study books includes like being upright on the Bodhisattva precepts, living by vow, things like this. So then the third section of 1 to 3 years is called the 1 to 3 years. Third path, third stage, yeah. Sometimes we don't like to use these words stages and Zen, calling them paths here. Circles, yeah. Circles within circles, yeah. So this is deep inquiry into non-duality.
As we go down the vortex.
Down the whirlpool. Deep inquiry into non-duality or emptiness. And often we get into this thing right from the start because we chant the Heart Sutra every day, right? But maybe more traditionally it would be like, first we really get grounded in the Buddha's early teachings and these compassion practices of bodhisattvas, because this emptiness business is very subtle. And you know, in this case, it's like one could take it up like after 6 years of practicing without ever hearing about that. I think would be okay. Maybe in Asia it's more like that. And please excuse me for constantly talking about this kind of thing anyway and just confusing newcomers. But one could take it up like this. Take up the study. The purpose of this path is to take up the study, contemplation, and living application of the profound view of selflessness, emptiness, and non-duality as taught in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, in the Middle Way teachings of Nagarjuna and so on, and the mind-only teachings of Vasubandhu and so on, and the Buddha Nature teachings. These are all within Mahayana Buddhism, where things get really fun and interesting. The commitment here is keep coming to these Bodhisattva precepts, renewal ceremonies, and also now being available to fulfill the role of head student or shuso for a practice period, which involves helping the practice leader to lead the practice period and giving Dharma talks in this room. So this is something not everybody does, but this would maybe be kind of ideal thing after like 6 or 7 years of really this is my practice place and practicing wholeheartedly and already keeping going the daily practice and regular sessions, all of those things. Ideally on this, keep going. That's maybe the hard part, right? I can do all these things for 1 year, but year after year, I'm still going to do like 5 days of sesshin. And in fact, this list actually starts, each section increases the amount. We might say that the, shouldn't it be the initial thing, and after you've been practicing for many years, you could kind of like phase out your formal practice. But in fact, I think it's kind of the other way around. That, my experience is that, the more I practice, the more I want to practice. It's a natural, the increase is a natural thing for myself. It is possible to kind of fall off the train. But, and also, as we practice more in the Sangha, we're more and more an example for others. So even if we don't really like to, we're practicing as an example. One time the Buddha was, sitting Zazen out in the forest after he was the Buddha, and a monk came up and said, "You're already totally enlightened. Why are you doing this like kind of difficult practice of like sitting out in the forest where it's kind of scary and you don't have to get to move and so on. And the Buddha said, for two reasons I sit out in the forest in Zazen, because I like to and because it's a good example for others. So we can be this way too. And so, yeah, being available to be shuso. There's a lot of people who have been practicing for a long time. It would be nice if they could be shuso. Usually it comes after receiving the precepts. You can't really be shuso without skipping that step. So that's another nice reason to do the Jukai ceremony. Practice here, because it's this deep inquiry into emptiness and so on, is learning to practice meditative inquiry, which is a little different than these other types of just resting in the present. It's more like questioning our actual experience, like, for example, looking for an independent self in our experience and not finding one during Zazen. So Suzuki Roshi says, around this kind of study of emptiness and so on, he says, we live in the world of time and space, and our life does not go beyond this limit. To live in the world of time and space is like pushing a big snake into a small can. The snake will suffer in the small can. It does not know what's going on outside the can. In other words, in a world where there's no time and space, we're in this can basically all the time. Because it is in the can, it's so dark, the snake cannot see anything, but it will struggle in the small can. That's what we are doing. The more we struggle, the greater the suffering will be. That kind of practice will not work. And then I thought this was interesting. I just came across this lecture from 1967. He says, putting yourself in a small can and sitting Zazen day after day in a cross-legged position is worse than a waste of time. So I think this is feeling as if we're in our regular old world of time and space, trapped in this limited experience of duality, and just plunking ourselves on a cushion. We have to start this way, I think. But at this stage of this deep inquiry into non-duality and emptiness, Zazen could be a waste of time. It looks good, but it's we're still in this small can. And then he says, do you understand? Sometimes our practice is something like this. We don't know how much our understanding is limited. And then he says, that's why you have to study koans. Koans will open up your mind. So it's a little rare Suzuki Roshi plug for koans, but I would take it as any kind of like inquiry, meditative inquiry practice, where we're actually investigating, trying to plumb the depths of what is going on here in this can, and what's going on outside the can. So time's running out, but this study here would involve things like the Heart Sutra and the third turning of the wheel and so on. And then the final fourth stage or path is Zen, even though that might be happening at the beginning, but this separate transmission outside the scriptures that's based on all these foundational teachings, it's based on all these compassion bodhisattva teachings, and it's based on these non-duality emptiness teachings. Zen burst forth out of all that, pointing directly to the mind, seeing our true nature, being Buddha. And in this very unusual expression, like Zen koans and Dogen's teachings and so on, are, I think, much harder than Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu, actually, because he's bringing out the same points, but in this very unusual way. So here we could learn the practice, if we already haven't, of turning the light around, or just sitting, or the self-enjoyment samadhi, non-dual awareness, and could explore the possibility of priest ordination, which here would be like after 3 to 6 years, which is maybe not that long. 3 years would be like somebody would be really gung-ho, but it could be 10 years, 15, and also practice here could be like doing a practice period or an intensive at Green Gulch or Tassajara, these kind of things. So that's my thoughts, and it's somewhat arbitrary, as you can imagine, this list of progression, but I like thinking of it. I mean, this kind of feel like my own path kind of went that way, and I see others doing it. And also, lest you think that Kokyo just lives in the monastery, so nobody could really practice all and study all of this stuff. There are people here who have not lived in the monastery, but have been practicing in this very room, like Patrick and Jean and Kathy, who are recently retired, but in all their many years of practicing here, had full-time jobs, pretty much, yeah? And did, like, went through all of this stuff. It's amazing. But, so it's just proof, it's a living proof that it's possible. In lay practice. So, as Dogen says, if there's willingness. So, hopefully, you can feel encouraged to practice however you feel is supportive and helpful, and to know that it's all available. You know, it's I think this place really offers a lot, and people can really tap in however they want. And if you want a lot, there's a lot available. And if you want a little, there's also a little available. So it's all okay. Sorry I didn't leave more time for questions, because I'd love to hear your feedback on all of this. Maybe at tea afterwards, if you can let me know what you think. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.